From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. It's a time of social ferment in and out of the food world, but the food world always responds. As I'm moving through this extraordinary period of time, more and more I'm thinking of it as two pandemics, one new and one as old as time, COVID-19 and racism. For many of us, food is comfort, a balm, but food can also be a weapon. Adrian Miller is a historian and author who acknowledges both, but he believes that food has the ability to reconcile.
When you sit down at a table with someone, you recognize their humanity. And cooking is an act of love, because when somebody cooks food for you, they're saying that they care about your survival.
Adrian goes by the moniker Soul Food Scholar. He was the deputy director of President Clinton's Initiative for One America. Now he focuses on the intersection of faith and food. Hi, Adrian.
Hi, good to be with you.
I'm so happy to have you. You call yourself a recovering lawyer and politico. The Initiative for One America, of which you were the deputy director during the Clinton time, what work did it focus on?
So it focused on racial, ethnic, and religious reconciliation. And the underpinning of it was the wild and crazy idea that if we just sat down and talked to one another and listened, we might realize that we have a lot more in common than what supposedly divides us.
And what years were you doing this work?
So I was there from 1999 to 2001. So I was at the very end of President Clinton's second term.
Do you think this moment is substantively different to affect another stab at moving the needle?
I think it is different because there have been times before where I thought we would be in this moment, really 5 years ago with the murders of the Bible study group at the AME church in Charleston, South Carolina. I thought that was going to be a triggering event, kind of like the bombing of the Birmingham church that killed the four little girls in the early 1960s, how that further galvanized the civil rights movement. Anecdotally, I can just tell you, it seems like more white people are paying attention, want to learn and want to engage on the issue. I just haven't seen this level of concern and wanting to do something before.
You know, so often on this show and in the media in general, we talk about food as a way to bring us together over the table. But so often that just feels completely ingenuous. There's a flip side. Food can just as easily be weaponized to tear us apart, can't it?
Oh, absolutely. And we have a deep history of that in this country. And I think it happens around the world as well. But I think particularly of the way food was weaponized against African Americans in the late 1800s. Stereotypes of African Americans in certain foods had certainly been floating around in our culture. But at a moment when African Americans had a modicum of civil and social and political rights, there was a propaganda campaign by cultural tastemakers that basically used food to make African Americans seem weird or childlike or even bestial. And the idea was like, look, you gave these people these rights. They don't really deserve them. Here's why. And it wasn't just in the South. Editors and people outside the South were happy to recycle these harmful images. And the most toxic were fried chicken and watermelon. And the goofiest thing about that, two things, is one, watermelon and fried chicken are delicious. And two, white people were eating those same foods. But it just shows you the power dynamic, how the stigma could be attached to African Americans. So much so that even today, I know people who are reluctant to eat fried chicken and watermelon around whites, and at least be photographed or filmed doing it.
Oh, that's just heartbreaking.
Yeah.
And angering. I'm curious to hear your thoughts about Aunt Jemima and Uncle Ben being shown the door.
Yes. So I think it's long overdue. And I think it's really interesting to see the reaction, both from African-Americans and whites about this, believing that these food figures are being erased, but they don't know the history. Aunt Jemima, Faustus for Cream of Wheat, and Uncle Ben, they go back to a time where society said black people had a certain role, and your role was servitude. And so you were supposed to be the happy servant and meet all the needs of whites. And so those are that's the background. That's the history, the roots of those images. Now, that history has not been passed on. So now we have people reacting to the removal in kind of very interesting and shocked ways, but they just don't know that history and what messaging those images sent, especially to African Americans.
I know that you're working on an upcoming book on barbecue called Black Smoke. Has barbecue also been weaponized?
Yeah, so we focus kind of on fried chicken and watermelon, but barbecue was on the list of foods that essentially were used as fodder for creating caricatures of African Americans. Really racist stuff. And so 100 years ago, Tin Pan Alley and vaudeville, which were kind of entertainment circles in our society, there were things called like the Darktown Barbecue. And you would see just kind of coon images of African Americans. And you see this not only in kind of literature and art and music, but you see it in film. There's several films that talk about African American barbecues, the spectacle of it. But again, it was the idea to show that African Americans were somehow weird. And at the same time, showing them as servants, because the idea was that Black people existed to make the very best barbecue. So 100 years ago, if you were thinking about the standard bearers for barbecue, it was African Americans.
So let's talk about your book, Black Smoke, in a bit more detail. Is it strictly history?
It starts out with the premise that, hey, African Americans have long been the standard bearers for excellent barbecue. Not the only ones. Of course, other people cooked barbecue, but people equated great barbecue with African Americans. And so it's really weird to be in this present time where in the media, very few African American barbecuers get love. So the idea is to go back to the roots and kind of trace the history and just make the case for why African Americans deserve much more attention and credit when you're talking about barbecue in this country.
So I'm sure that one part of this kind of research is eating, but what else does it involve?
Is there anything else that should be involved? No, I'm just kidding. So, yeah, so part of it was going through those oral histories of enslaved people and just seeing how barbecue evolved in the antebellum period. And why were enslaved African Americans the ones forced to make barbecue? And before that, it was enslaved Native Americans. So it was parsing that. And then just reading old digitized newspapers and magazines, because those media platforms were really about capturing daily life in the life of a community. And in a lot of those publications, they talked about these African Americans. Now, it wasn't until the late 1800s that they started to actually give these barbecuers name. But by the late 1800s, they named them, they kind of interviewed them and asked them for their techniques and secrets. And that's just the level of recognition that you don't see in other aspects of cooking around that time. So barbecue had a certain reverence attached to it.
Currently, you're the executive director of the Colorado Council of Churches. You're the first African-American and the first lay person to hold that position. The mission of the group is to walk together in faith, work together for justice. Where does food justice come into your work there?
So it's been really interesting. There's been a real awakening within Christian circles about dealing with issues of food justice, because for the longest time, churches have definitely responded in terms of charity. We have food banks, you know, pantries. When an emergency happens, we show up. But there's more thinking about, okay, why are people constantly hungry? Why is food insecurity such a persistent problem? And that means changing the system, and that means questions of justice. So what you're starting to see are more churches using their vast acreage of land to actually have community gardens, to teach people how to farm on their own property. So we're seeing a lot of interesting things there. We're seeing more people try to use food as a tool of reconciliation. One of the best events that we had at the Council of Churches is a couple years ago, and this was right after the murders of the Bible study group in Charleston, South Carolina. By chance, we were already working on this, but we had a big potluck. And we just said, bring food from your tradition, sit down at the table and just talk to somebody you don't know, and then see if there's ways that your churches can do work together to build fellowship. And the idea was to pair Black and white churches. And it was interesting because, you know, some people showed up with vegan soul food. So I had to say a quick prayer, but it was very good. In fact, vegan is one of the hottest trends in soul food. But I have to tell you, before that event, there was a lot of cynicism from Black pastors. They just did not think that white churches really wanted to do the lengthy and hard work of reconciliation And a few churches did enter those partnerships. But sure enough, after a few weeks, one of the white pastors told me, yeah, my congregants are kind of wondering why we keep doing this. And that just reinforced what the black pastors thought.
Well, we have to hope for this moment to deepen and stay.
Amen.
Why do you think that food creates a moment for us to come together? And what do you think the meaning is of that?
Well, I think in this time, because we have so few spaces now where we can come together and in so few ways to come together, I think food is one of those that can work, because we all have to eat. And when you sit down at a table with someone, you recognize their humanity. And cooking is an act of love, because when somebody cooks food for you, they're saying that they care about your survival. They're saying that they love you in a way. I mean, even if the food is straight nasty, right? The act of cooking is showing some love. And what I've found in my work with the Clinton White House and other arenas is that when there are race dialogues, if it's just about coming together to talk about race, they usually dissipate after several meetings because they just lose steam for whatever reason. But whenever the race dialogue is tied to some other activity that brings people enjoyment and gives people a chance to get to know each other and build relationship, those seem to have more staying power. So I think food allows us to kind of relax, maybe put our guard down a little bit, explore another culture, and start to get to know people and build relationships that can be the foundation for then talking about the really tough things.
Thank you so much, Adrian.
Thank you.
That was historian and author Adrian Miller, a.k.a. Soul Food Scholar. He's the author of 2 award-winning books and is currently writing Black Smoke, African-American Adventures in Barbecue. Coming up, baba ganoush, bright, zingy herb salads, and talk of politics on the side. Sammy Tamimi, the famed chef partner in the Ottolenghi Empire, stops by to talk about his latest book, Falestine. Welcome back to Good Food. Summertime is for eating outdoors. Whether it's grilling or picnics, I have a suspicion that this year many of us will be eating in the backyard more often than we ever have. When I think of eating outside, I think of long, leisurely meals, maybe with some grilled meat or fish, some bright salads for contrast, and just a huge spread of options to graze on. In other words, I think about the food of the Middle East. Sammy Tamimi is the famed Palestinian partner of Yotam Ottolenghi in the Ottolenghi food businesses. We started exploring his new book, Falestine, for Ramadan, and we're eager to check back for more now that summer's upon us. Hi, Sammy.
Hi, thanks for having me again.
Oh, we're so happy to have you. Tell me, when I think about, you know, eating outside, I always think about having some dippy things.
Yeah.
So can you talk about baba ganoush and mutabal and talk about the rules and how they're different?
I mean, essentially, they're both the same thing. Slight the name change, because baba ganoush is a Lebanese term for the same, basically, dish. But in Lebanon, sometimes they add yogurt to it instead of the tahini that we do. But essentially, you know, it's down to how you grill or burn the aubergine really kind of well until they're so charred and the skin is flaky. And this is what gives the dish its kind of typical flavor, which is, you know, it's kind of melt in the mouth and creamy and also smoky at the same time. And some part of the Levant, they also add pomegranate molasses to it, which is add a little bit another element to the dish, which is kind of sweet, sour, kind of hidden flavor that you can't actually recognize, but you know it's there.
So often when we're setting up a menu for grilling, we like to have things on the side that are have a bit of sourness, have a lot of pops of flavor to go with the meat, which can be kind of one note, even though delicious. You have a spicy herb salad that That seems like a great accompaniment.
It's actually quite delicious. I mean, this dish need to be prepared like an hour before, and just kind of, because it's so delicate, you just need to be eaten straight ahead. So you basically pick all the herbs and keep it in a chill place, and then just toss it just before serving. I mean, I think it's a salad that goes with a lot of things, particularly grilled meats and fish. And it's got this really refreshing cucumber kind of minty tone to it, which is really can complement any dish on the barbecue.
Give us a rundown of some of the ingredients besides the cucumber and the mint.
You know, we kept it kind of open so people can actually do what they like. But tarragon and dill and basil and mint and parsley, coriander, any soft herb that, you know, they available, you can use baby spinach, arugula, any kind of lamb lettuce, any kind of soft but not, you know, not harsh type of leaf can also go there. And it's got some bit of seeds into it. The main kind of flavoring is lemon juice. The cucumber are kind of shaved into ribbons and slightly pickled.
So I started my vegetable garden early this year because, well, I was home and had way
like
too
the rest of us.
Yeah, and had way too much time on my hands. So every empty pot got a plant. So I'm looking at what to do with zucchini and tomatoes about now.
Yeah.
You have a nice salad that's a play on something that's usually sort of pureed, but this is more chunky.
Yeah, the mafusa, we call it, which is, it translates to kind of cracked or smashed. It's a beautiful kind of example of what to do with, you know, in a season, vegetable like zucchini and the tomatoes. You can do it also with eggplant as well, where you just kind of grill them whole, and then the tomatoes I slightly kind of peel, they kind of easily peeled, and then just roughly chop it, and then you dress it with the kind of very garlicky yogurt. You can add tahini if you like, and again, we have date molasses in it and lots of chili, mint and parsley. So, yeah, it's just a very kind of clean, but, you know, the only flavor in there is the lemon, mint, and the garlic. And it looks spectacular as well. And this is a dish that goes, you know, with everything. You know, I would just eat it with, you drizzle it kind of generously with olive oil and just dip bread in it and eat it like that.
Yeah, it's gorgeous. So can we talk about shata?
Yes, of course.
It's the first recipe I made when the galleys came. And since that time, months ago, I haven't been without a jar of it. It's addicting and perfect and so easy to make. Can you describe what it is and how it's made?
Yeah, I mean, because in the Middle East, they have chilies in abundance and they don't keep for a long time. And, you know, the old days, they didn't have fridges, and they invented this kind of fermentation process where you chop the chilies, and you can choose actually what type of chilies you want. If you like it very hot, you can use like serrano and a bit of jalapeno, or, you know, and they will chop it and add quite a lot of salt to it and leave it in a cool place or in the fridge for 3 days. And after the 3 days, you basically just blitz it in a food processor. You add to it a bit of vinegar and lemon to the lemon and the vinegar. It's to just make it first of all to preserve it a little bit better, but also it makes the spiciness less kind of the case in shatta. It's not supposed to be hot. It's supposed to be kind of mild hot with another tone of sweet from the chilies and sourness from the acidity from the vinegar and the lemon. And you just top it with olive oil and leave it in the fridge. I mean, I leave mine in the cupboard. I don't leave it in the fridge because, you know, here in the UK, it's not very hot. So it will keep really well for up to 3 weeks. And you can add it to everything. I mean,
everything.
You know it already.
Yeah.
I mean, I add it to everything. I mean, this morning I had a piece of a cheese on a toast and I just added chato on top. It's also it's a very good appetizer. You know, you can just put it in something to start the meal and people want to kind of eat more. And it's just kind of really Moorish and delicious.
One of the great things about Falestine, the book, aside from just the recipes, which of course are wonderfully enticing, are the stories. And I'm wondering if you could talk about the story that's titled A Tale of Two Restaurateurs. So it's sort of the politics or not of food. These two chefs, one in Haifa, one in Nazareth.
Yeah, I mean, the older guy in Nazareth, he have a kind of a long history of establishment. First, he started in Jerusalem and then he moved back to Nazareth. He's very opinionated about everything and anybody and any, you know, his politics are kind of in his DNA, and he want to kind of talk about it all the time, and he wants to argue with people about things, and people don't come without having a drink, for example, or he plays quite loud classical Arabic music. You either like it or don't, but you know, if you come to his place, you don't have a say about, you know, what kind of music or how loud is it. His restaurant is called Rida, and his name is Daher Zidani.
And who's the other chef?
The other chef, his name is Musa. He's a very young, ambitious chef that learned his trade in Europe, and he opened a fish seafood restaurant in Akkar. And it's a beautiful setting, and it's mainly cater for tourists. He's doing really well, but also, you know, because he studied in Europe, he wanted to do a little bit kind of delicious, sexy food. And he's not really interested in any of the politics. He doesn't really want to talk about any. I mean, I one point I asked him, how do you describe yourself? And he said, I prefer not to talk about that. And I said, what do you mean? It's just kind of, I'm just asking you a question. And he said, look, I'm a chef. I want to cook. This is what I do best. And let's leave it there.
Do you think it's because so much of his clientele is Israeli?
I mean, I think most of his clientele are Israeli, probably 90, 95%. It shouldn't really affect, you know, the fact that you can actually say I'm Palestinian and or I'm an Arab Israeli. Or I mean, this part of the world, you know, everything you talk, it's loaded, and you know, it turns into politics before you even know it.
Sammy, thank you so much. It's a fantastic book.
Thank you very much, and thank you for having me.
That was Chef Sammy Tamimi, famed partner of Yotam and the Ottolenghi Food Empire, and author alongside Tara Wigley of a gorgeous new cookbook, Falestine. In a minute, from local to Chewbox, Roy Choi joins me with Kim Gaston to talk about their latest project next. You're listening to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman. Crisis always breeds opportunity, and one bright spot over the past few months has been the public realizing what we in the business always knew, how creative and nimble food people are in the face of survival. And Chef Roy Choi has been one of our best examples of nimble creativity with a heart for years. His latest project, Chewbox, co-founded with Kim Gaston, is a simple yet fascinating project that solves a few problems all at once. Hello, men. How are you?
Hello.
Hi there.
Kim, how have you been doing?
I've been running, making a lot of deliveries lately. So I'm personally actually going to a lot of customers and delivering them lunches. It's a good problem.
And you, Roy, how have you been?
I've been chilling, man. Kim doing all the work, you know. For once in my life, I get to chill. I've been stuck in quarantine with this project, Chewbox. you know, I almost have to hold myself back because this is Kim's. Kim is the CEO and the vision, and I'm his sous chef, and I'm his assistant coach. But in between, yeah, I'm just trying to figure this whole quarantine thing out like the rest of y'all. Man, I spin around in my head every day.
Yeah. Kim, could you describe what Chewbox is for us?
Wow, Chewbox is a lot of things. What it is fundamentally is it's a reimagination of food, services as a perpetual means of creating social justice in the world. So historically, our government has decided where people live, and these people get to live here, these people get to live there. So you have communities like Watts that have historically for the last like 40 years been low income. And by placing a ghost kitchen in Watts with multi-million dollar equipment and empowering and partnering everyday people from Watts, you know, some of the best cooks in Watts, to partner with people like Roy and Daniel to learn how to make the best meals, and then pushing those meals out through the county, it allows for people all over the county to make a choice every day to route their income, their disposable income that they're using towards meals, to the people of Watts. Every time you want a chef-made meal delivered to you on time every day for $10, like delivery included, we got you. And we believe we can take this as a pilot and take it everywhere around the country because there's a Watts in every major city.
So who are the primary people that you're feeding? On the website, you focus on teachers, but teachers aren't so much in a place anymore.
So when I first came in with this, Roy and I sat down and I told him I was really adamant about it as a technology. We wanted to make sure Chewbox had a private market. I don't know if everyone recalls, but in order to use Gmail in the beginning, you had to work for Google or be invited by someone who worked for Google. This is important. It's like an incubation period for all technology, for all great apps. Facebook at one time was just for college students. So when we started Chewbox, we wanted to focus on a customer who food services as a whole hadn't evolved to serve. And we started with a small pilot with school teachers because school teachers are all over the county and they're all over South Central Los Angeles and they're all over Watts. But what people don't realize about school teachers is, and by school teachers, I don't just mean the ones in the classroom. Half of all adults working on school campuses, on public school campuses, are not teachers in the classroom, but they all have the same lunch problem, which is that they have 30 minutes between bells to receive and consume meals and be back on duty. My father was a school teacher in Compton Unified School District for 30 years. I watched him gain 150 pounds because he either would skip lunch or he darts out when the bell rings to the nearest food service, which is usually a fast food place, and that's not sustainable. Or he would have to make his own meals. And even with that, you have to make sure that you remember to bring your meal, right? Because he has all these papers and things like that, right? You know, teachers are a vastly underserved population when it comes to lunch. So we opened this up for teachers initially, and then we launched, we learned. It was amazing. Teachers were using Chewbox 2 and 3 times a week. That's how important it was. If we could get them a chef-made meal that was there in the teacher's lounge and was warm and ready to consume when the bell rang. So what we were able to see from that was that, you know, this particular problem that we solved was scalable. We learned, we revamped the site, and literally, and Roy can speak to this, he was at Jordan High School getting ready to, like, launch this thing in Watts. And that's when the mayor, the governor, and the head of LAUSD, you know, had decided, okay, well, the school teachers are not coming back tomorrow. So we were kind of, like, a bit thrown for about 24 hours, and then we realized what happened. What happened was everyone was going to start staying at home and working from home. So everyone was going to be in the same position school teachers were in.
So is there a delivery area? What is the breadth of it? And what does the consumer-facing part of the website look like?
So this is an app. It's a native app that you download for iOS or Android. For Android users, you're going to have to give us a few more weeks because we really had to focus on iOS. But it's there for both iOS and Android. And the delivery radius is Los Angeles County currently. So if you live within LA County, we deliver to you between 11 a.m. and 1 p.m. daily. what you'll see when you download the app is the first thing you see is what everyone else is ordering. So we made it kind of a social thing, right? The second thing you'll see are the kitchens you can order from. Local has a kitchen. Chef Roy Choi has his own kitchen. There's various other people, including Rob McCovery and folks who have their own kitchens as well. And you can simply add meals to your meal calendar days, weeks, even months in advance.
So Roy, was your entry into this project a great deal influenced by the fact that you had this incredible kitchen local?
I would say that was a part of it. I think more so that we have this incredible neighborhood and family of Watts, you know, that I was still a part of. And our investors and our partners and everyone still, we just kind of went into kind of standby mode. And we just kind of turned all the engine burners down to low. And we still had a vision of what we wanted to do. We knew that local had broke ground on something. Our first attempt was retail, you know, point of sale retail. It worked for so long, but as a business, it only lasted almost, you know, 2.5 years. But as a concept, it enlightened so many things. It brought so much conversation and attention to the problem of disparity in food access. It provided over 100 jobs for almost 3 years. It provided a pathway for almost 15 of our folks from local to go on to other kitchens, even run kitchens on their own just by working at local. So there were a lot of successes within local. And for me, even though it took some conversation for Kim and I to figure out where our point of intersection met, from the beginning that I met Kim, I knew that this was kind of the path to the second chapter of local. For us as chefs, we think of like, okay, we make this thing, we buy it for $4, we'll sell it for $6, and then we move on to the next thing. We're not that complicated of people. But with Kim, he's created this network where it's not only just a one-on-one sale. You can buy meals for others. You can buy meals for yourself ahead of time. You can gift things. You can bring other people in that don't have the resources to start their own kitchens or their own restaurants or their own businesses. And we can create almost virtual kitchens. So this is like even the next level beyond where food trucks were.
Yeah, I mean, it's really a tremendous idea. Kim, I'm curious. It seems like Chewbox is this three-legged stool. There are the kitchens, there are the eaters. Who are the drivers? Is that an important part of the stability of the stool, so to speak?
It absolutely is. So right now in Los Angeles County, we have one delivery window that's from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. We may add a dinner service very shortly, but for the most part, our drivers are working about 90 minutes to 2 hours at the most, maybe 2.5 hours for us a day. And during that time, they're able to make quite a bit of money. And what we initially did was we thought about the fact that there are people who in the community of Watts who everyone knows can cook and may just need a little bit of mentorship and guidance to go from good to great. And then there are people who can come in and assemble, you know, meals. Once the chefs push them out, they can assemble and package them. But there are people in the neighborhood and who are in South Central who have cars that work and would have no problem driving for us a few hours a day. We think that this is a game changer, for example, for single moms, because this is the kind of thing where you can add, you know, thousands of dollars a month in income just from coming to one location and picking up what we call a chew box, which is the actual delivery box that we have, the bag that we use for that. You pick it up, there's dozens of meals in there, and you go on a route.
This is kind of like a paper route, you know, like it's kind of like at the core of what America, like old school 50s Americana was built around. But at a time when our whole idea and conception of what America is being challenged. And that idyllic kind of Norman Rockwell universe of what we thought America is really about, there was a whole population of people, especially African Americans, that were left out of that. And it's kind of like this weird circle between what America could have been and should have been, but wasn't, and then kind of reinvented in a new modern age, but still with that same, but including everybody, and especially including the people that were left out.
So we haven't talked about the food yet. Tantalize us. Give us like one really popular choice
The funny thing about it is our best seller since we started this, when we were testing with teachers, when we opened to the public, it is absolutely Roy Choi's Korean barbecue torta. One of our most heated conversations ultimately led to the birth of this torta because I was telling Roy, I'm like, you have got to put your foot in this thing, man. Like, take that, the brand and, you know, put the Roy Choi brand on this thing. You know, he just kind of like took a day and came back with this, and we were just all blown away. So I'll let Roy talk about it because it's actually brilliantly designed the way he created it.
Well, I don't know about brilliant, but, you know, thank you, though.
It's brilliant, bro. No.
But, well, you know, I mean, there's some backstory in depth to why it took me a little bit of coercing to get me to that point, Evan, is because when we started local, I didn't want to overpower the local brand. You know, like, you know, Kogi is such a juggernaut. I can't even change the recipes at Kogi because if I do, people are going to be pissed. You know,
I and understand. It's
like, you know, as a chef, I want to, you know, I want to evolve like everything about it. But it's like, you know, people love it. And also Kogi is such a beast, you know, and everything that it does and its identity and everything. And it's like a purple dye in a glass of water. Once it enters something, it just takes over. With local, I never wanted to take over like that. It was more always about Watts and about the vision and about the dream than it was about me making a footprint into the flavor. So when Kim came to me, for him, he didn't know any of that history, you know? And he's just coming to me like, yo, why are you not putting your banger on the album? You know, it's like, why are you holding back? And, you know, it's like, oh, okay. And then, you know what? And then I confronted it finally. It's like, what am I holding on to? So we put on the Korean barbecue torta. It's a beautiful sandwich. It's kind of like a semita sandwich. It's melty, tangy, filled with lots of aromatics and deep flavors. And then it's got this soft kind of roll that's crispy and on the inside, and it's kind of semi-pressed, and yeah, it's beautiful. It's like eating a burrito, but it's a sandwich. The menu is a very unique menu. I mean, it's a menu that is like a co-op. It's like everyone has a voice in it, and everyone has a flavor within it. So you can have shrimp and grits, then Korean barbecue torta. You can come back around and have a salad, and then next week you can have a creamy shrimp taco, and then you can go over and have tomato soup or broccoli and cheese soup, you know. So it's all over the place in a very good way.
Well, gentlemen, thank you so much for coming and talking to us about such an interesting idea.
Thank you guys for having us.
That was Chef Roy Choi and Kim Gastone, co-founders of Chewbox. Stay with us. We dive into the melting pot of Romanian food next. I'm Evan Kleiman, and this is Good Food. Aside from trips to the frozen food aisle and self-checkout lanes, travel appears to be out of the question for the foreseeable future. But escapism through food is a way to stamp our culinary passports. Say Romanian food, and perhaps peppers and polenta or mamaliga come to mind, but history and geography have played a huge role in creating a fascinatingly diverse cuisine in this Eastern European country. Irina Georgescu takes us on a very special journey in her book, Carpathia. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
I'm excellent, and you?
I'm fine, thank you.
What is Carpathia? Is it a place?
Carpathia is not a place. Carpathia comes from the Carpathian Mountains because they are such an imposing presence in the Romanian landscape.
So talk about this extraordinary melting pot of cultures and cuisine that Romanian food holds all together.
Romanian cuisine is a mosaic of culinary influences from Greek, Turkish, German, Russian, French, Hungarian cultures all come together in this book and in heartwarming recipes. And this is Romanian cuisine. It's a great fusion. All these influences make a very good meal together.
In the book, you talk about the coexistence of the old Byzantine cuisine. Is this what you mean?
I mean by that the Greek and the Turkish influences. Obviously, we have our what we call placinta, which are pies, but are layered pies or layered breads, or they can be anything. And placinta are an old Roman dish, but it's also Greek as well. So this is the Byzantine influence into the Romanian cuisine. The south and the east of the country were under the Ottoman Empire for centuries. The Carpathian Mountains actually created a natural border between the Ottoman Empire and the Habsburg Empire, the Austro-Hungarian Empire in the north, so in Transylvania. So we have these influences in the south, but then crossing the mountains, we have a very Saxon, very German and Hungarian cuisine. So all this together are now on what is today Romania.
You grew up in Bucharest under communist rule. Could you describe your childhood, your family, and what was required in terms of ingenuity in the kitchen?
I think communist regime really influenced our cookery. And I think about it as a layer of in our history. Imagine the fact that everything was nationalized. For instance, in the countryside, peasants didn't have any land. In a way, they nationalized skills as well. So if you were a family, for instance, who probably used to make cheese following a family recipe, then you'd stop doing that. So we lost that skill in a way. And this happened to charcuterie as well, and also to wine. So we lost quite a lot from what it was, the regional artisan skills of people. But growing up in a city was quite complicated because we were all depending on what was in the shops. And very often there was nothing in the shops. We had some tins of sardines and some cans of beetroot or something like that, but nothing like flour and oil and butter or anything like that. Especially towards the end of the communist regime, things got really bad and food was rationed and we used to queue for hours to get some staple ingredients and sometimes actually go back home empty-handed because there was not enough food for everyone. So obviously we had at some point, we had some sort of a biscuit cake that wasn't with chocolate at all. It was just with some cocoa powder and some water and some biscuits. And that was a sort of a dessert we used to have. Another dessert was a sort of white bean cake that was made from butter beans, for instance, with walnuts and some oil and some eggs. And that was all. So we actually had to improvise like this.
When the communist regime fell, and food started to become more available. Did these traditions that must have been held in the brains and arms of older women start to come back?
Yes. Romanians love traditional food. When we want to celebrate, we cook Romanian food or we go to a Romanian restaurant. And also, because we learn to cook from our mothers and grandmothers, cooking and the recipes are really personal to us. If it's not cooked like my mom used to cook it, then I don't think the recipe is correct, you know. So we really have this personal connection with our food. So there are some things here that we go back to our traditional cookery, but also we want to integrate new ingredients, you see, because it's all about progress and it's all about change. So we don't say no to those either.
So let's talk about the seasonality of the cuisine. It's so interesting because when most of us think about seasonal cooking, we're led purely by ingredients and season. But you talk about how in Romania, cooks turn to different culinary cultures depending on the season.
Yes. I refer to the fact that during the summer, we kind of cook Greek and Turkish more than we do in the winter when we cook more German, let's put it this way, or Hungarian. And it's because of the climate. Obviously, summers are really hot and you don't want to be in the kitchen. So you want to be outside. We barbecue a lot. We char grill vegetables and barbecue meats, and we serve them with salads. We barbecue fish as well. We serve them with salads. So it's a very, how can I say it, instant flavors of cooking outside.
So let's talk about the summer palate more. It seems that Romanians love to bake with fruit. And I have to say that the apricot yogurt cake looks just perfect for us. Tell us about this recipe.
It is an amazing recipe. And I wanted to put it there because it was part of our repertoire. You know, my mom was making this all the time when apricots were in season. And the beauty of it is also that it uses sour cream, yogurt in the mix, which is something specific to Romania as well. We put a lot of dairy, well, fermented dairy, like buttermilk and sour cream and yogurt in our bakes. So that is quite important and really trendy nowadays. You know, I can see it everywhere now. But because the climate is so good for growing vegetables and you know, have the fruit trees and everything, we have to use these fruits. And when they are in season, are full of flavor. So obviously we use them in cakes. And after that, to preserve them, we kind of cold smoke or put them in confitures or in jams. But we love fresh fruit. And this particular recipe also goes well with cherries, or if you can find, but I can't find it here in the UK, but if you can find sour cherries, it's just an amazing recipe with sour cherries as well.
Well, thank you so much, Irina. It's an absolutely beautiful book.
Oh, thank you very much. And thank you very much for having me here.
That's Irina Georgescu, Romanian food writer and cooking instructor. Her blog is called Life in Small Bites, and her first cookbook is Carpathia. From Romanian food to Hungarian food, Jillian Ferguson is at the farmer's market with one cook who's combining her Hungarian roots with Southern California produce.
This is Jillian Ferguson with the Market Report. We are at the Echo Park Farmer's Market this week at the corner of Sunset and Logan. And I'm here with cook and artist Eden Botke, who's shopping here today. Hi, Eden.
Hi, Jillian.
It's great to see you. So, Eden, I have really enjoyed following your career. Because you're an artist, you have a very different career path than some of the chefs we talk to on this show. You don't have a restaurant. Every time I've eaten your food, it's been at an event, at a pop-up, and oftentimes at an art gallery. But now we don't have events. We don't have pop-ups these days because of the pandemic. So I'm curious to hear how you're sharing your food with people these days.
Yeah. It's been difficult. At the very beginning of the pandemic, of course, I thought, okay, all my jobs have dried up, so I'm going to cook for people and deliver it to people. Then from a friend's suggestion, she said, hey, since you're doing this Hungarian thing, you should probably just get a little more focused and do only in Hungarian menus. So I've done a couple of them so far and people have been happy. I'm American, Hungarian, I haven't really known very many Hungarians growing up, but it's the only ethnicity that I feel I can grab onto. And in Los Angeles, when I moved here 17 years ago, there were 3 Hungarian restaurants and now there are none.
When I look at your menu, I'm seeing a sort of California riff on Hungarian food. What are you shopping for today and what will be available this week for delivery?
So Hungarian food is not known for being very veggie heavy, herb heavy. So the things that I'm trying to do are insert all those things that I love and the California produce. And it's not only California produce, but it's Hungarian produce as well, because when I was there, last year and spent a good amount of time, I realized, okay, they have all this stuff. It's just not what you're seeing on the menus at restaurants. You need to go to homes, you need to go to farms, you need to go to farmers markets, you need to check stuff out. So on my menu this week, I have an oxtail braise with cherries and red wine. I'll do a stuffed cabbage with probably cornmeal and pork. It'll have sauerkraut and tomatoes. And I'm also going to make this dish. It's called Füzelék. Hungarians have this thing where they say it's not a soup, but it's not a puree. But it's, and I'm thinking, well, okay, so it's kind of just a soup then, right? No, it's not a soup. But it uses all the seasonal ingredients, but they'll usually focus on one thing. So it'll either be a sorrel or a spinach or parsley or a yellow bean puree or green peas or squash. So it's like any number of things. And then it usually is vegetarian, but sometimes they'll put either some smoked pork or bacon to flavor it, or they'll do a meatball, little meatball with just some light spices, garlic and stuff. I really like it. You can have it hot or cold, and it's always thickened with either a roux or a sour cream, a yogurt, and it's cool because you can just get really creative with it. So I was going to do this week a wax bean füzelék. It's showcasing the vegetable, but it's also, you're also adding the fat and the roux and, you know, the salt, which is great. But I'm curious in how we can pare back that extra stuff a little bit and just give it more of the freshness.
Well, I'm really looking forward to it. Thank you so much, Eden.
Thank you so much.
That was Eden Bhatke. You can find out more about her meal delivery service via her Instagram, @EdenBhatke. Tomash Lehman of Lehman Family Farm brings his produce to the Echo Park Farmers Market every Friday afternoon. The Lehman Family Farm sits on about 5 acres in between Palmdale and Victorville. And Tomash, you describe yourself as an accidental farmer. How'd you end up in this profession?
Well, you know, it's a long story, but originally I'm a carpenter, and when I come out to the United States, I start working in the construction, and when the business went down, we was thinking what else we can do. And because we always grow something in the backyard, because fresh vegetables, a lot healthier, and special food, what we like to eat, we start growing, and we ended up with so much. So we just called our friends, give away a little bit, and the next day they called us back, like, hey, do you have more? Yes, but it's not free anymore. It was a sample. I don't care, just bring it more. So that's how we ended up start the farming, and actually it turned out really good.
And you moved to the United States from Hungary. I know when you first moved here, you were growing a lot of Hungarian vegetables. Are you still doing that?
Yes, we're still doing that. Not that much like how we started, because most of the time we like to help the customers, whatever vegetables they like it. And I always tell them, like, if they have any idea what kind of vegetables they miss it, we try to grow it. Just like 2 years ago, we started growing the turmeric, which is really hard in the desert, but we find out how we can do that. And now we're growing also turmeric, middle of the desert.
So I spotted some sorrel on your table. Is that traditionally a Hungarian ingredient?
Yes, and also it's not with the Hungarians. It's very very popular with the Romanians and the Russian people. As I know, the Russian people like the soup out from the sorrel. We make sauce, and because the people here really don't know much about the sorrel, as the flavor like lemony, they really like it in the juice and smoothies or even pesto.
And the leaves on your table are so large. Is it considered an herb or is it a lettuce?
Well, none of them, I guess. You know, back at Hungary, it's just growing in the wild. But here we have to work really hard with everything, even lettuce, even like fruits or any other kind of vegetables. But the sorrel also really like the shady area. So first time in the summer, we was unable to grow them. But now, because I created really good soil, they're just growing really nice.
Is it a seasonal ingredient or can you grow it year-round?
I can grow all year round because my soil is really good. We use only the compost, no chemical fertilizer, and that's the secret.
Wow. Are you in a farming community, or is it unique that you are farming where you are?
No, it's not a community. Basically, as I said, we just middle of the desert, and we like to do as a hobby. And of course, we try to work together with the other farmers, changing the knowledge each other in which area, how they're growing, and we try to do everything the best as possible.
Well, it's really great to meet you. Thank you so much, Tomáš.
I thank you too.
That was Tomáš Lehmann of Lehmann Family Farms. You can find him at the Friday Echo Park Farmers Market on Sunset and Logan. For the Market Report, I'm Jillian Ferguson.
And that's it for this week's show. A quick announcement to everyone listening. If you work in the hospitality industry and have thoughts on the reopening and reclosing of restaurants, we want to hear from you. Are you an owner, a line cook, a bartender, a server? Send us an email at goodfood@kcrw.org. You can DM us on Twitter or Instagram. We'd love to hear how you feel about the current state of restaurants. If you missed any of today's show, listen on our website or on KCRW's mobile app. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or Spotify. So many thanks from me to the Good Food team, Jillian Ferguson, Laurel Garcia, and Desmond Taylor. Special thanks to Paul Smith, Laura Kondarajan, Amy Ta, and Kenny Ng. Take a cue from Arena and make an apricot yogurt cake before all that gorgeous fruit leaves the market. I know that at least one of my lunches this week is going to be from Chewbox. You should check it out too. I'll be back next week with a new episode of Good Food.